1 Samuel 11 through 12, the seventh talk in a series on 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on December 17, 2006, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 1 Samuel chapters 11 and 12 today. This is going to be my last time in 1 Samuel for a while. Next week I'm planning to do something different. It's something that I've been wanting to do. I hope it works out well. I'm going to look at and think about what information God had given to the people of Israel with respect to the coming Messiah by the time that Jesus came. We'll be looking at starting in chapter 11. If you'll recall, Samuel had been asked by the people of Israel to appoint a king for them. He said that was a bad idea. God agreed that was a bad idea, but told Samuel to appoint one anyway. And God selected out of the people of Israel the man Saul to be anointed by Samuel. And Samuel anointed him privately. Samuel and Saul were the only ones there when that happened. But then later, the people of Israel were all gathered together in an assembly, and by lots, someone was selected, and Saul was the one that was selected by lots. And that was a very public event at which all the representatives of Israel were there and saw it. But, as we noted at the end of chapter 10, there's an ominous verse, the last verse. It says, "But certain worthless men said, 'How can this one deliver us?' And they despised him, and they did not bring him any present, but he kept silent." So there is dissent within the nation of Israel, that there are at least some who are not willing to accept the authority of Saul as king. So interestingly, Saul doesn't begin to operate as king right away. Saul goes home and continues farming, continues doing what he was doing before he was selected as king. So that's where we pick up the action in chapter 11. First five verses. "Now Nahash the Amorite came up and besieged Jabesh Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, 'Make a covenant with us, and we will serve you.' But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, 'I will make it with you on this condition, that I will gouge out the right eye of every one of you. Thus I will make it a reproach on all Israel.' And the elders of Jabesh said to him, 'Let us alone for 7 days, that we may send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. Then if there is no one to deliver us, we will come out to you.' Then the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and spoke these words in the hearing of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices and wept. Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen, and he said, 'What is the matter with the people that they weep?' So they related to him the words of the men of Jabesh." Okay, we don't know how long it was between the time when the Israelites met in the assembly, when Saul was selected as king, and the events of this chapter. It's not clear. But in any case, it's clear that the people of Israel are not thinking in terms of being a kingdom. They aren't acting like they are a kingdom. They aren't acting like Saul is king. And Saul is not acting like he is king. We have an invasion of the Ammonites coming from the east. And as we will find out later in chapter 12, it's this threat from the east that really gave rise to their request for a king. That they are more concerned about this threat from Nahash than they were from the Philistines. And he does indeed launch an assault against Israel, and he besieges the city of Jabesh-Gilead. If you have a map and you want to look at the map, it's on the east side of the Jordan, but it's not too far from the Jordan, so it's on the slopes of the Transjordan. And that's a fairly deep incursion into Israelite territory. So the Ammonites have made quite an invasion into Israelite territory. He besieges the town of Jabesh-Gilead, and the people of Jabesh-Gilead give up. Now, it's not clear how long this siege had lasted. We know in the ancient world that there were times when sieges last years, but in most cases it was a matter of months. It all depends on how well-equipped and defended Jabesh-Gilead was. But in any case, the people in the city have come to the end of their resources. They are to the place where they want to surrender. They want to give up. And they want to make an agreement with Nahash. And it's an agreement that the people of Israel have been making for 200 years. That is to say that there have been lots of invaders who have come into various areas of Israel and subjected the Israelite population to them, to serve them. And this is another instance where Israelites are being pressed to capitulate to an invader and to serve another nation. Nahash is quite arrogant in his response. He says, okay, I'll make a peace treaty with you, but there will be a cost. The right eye of every one of you will be removed. And he says, thus I will make it a reproach on all Israel. Now, I don't know exactly what he's thinking, why he would do that, but it could be a military strategy, that is one of intimidation, that if he exacts this much of a price from the people of this city that he has besieged, that the next city that he goes to might capitulate much more easily before it comes to this. And it's not just a reproach on that city, but on all Israel. So this has propaganda value, that he expects to go out into all of Israel. Well, the elders of Jabesh are reluctant to give up their right eyes. And so they say, they have a counter proposal. Give us 7 days that we can send word out to the rest of Israel. And if no one comes to our aid, then we will just give up. Well, when you read that, the thing that comes to my mind is, what's in it for Nahash? I mean, you don't see any benefit there. Nahash must think, he must be really arrogant here and think, you know, there is no chance that Israel, the people of Israel, are going to come to the aid of this city. That they are so splintered, so fragmented, that there is no chance that they're going to be able to mount a counterattack. So he says, sure, go ahead. So I suspect his thinking is, I'm going to show how dominant I am and how strong I am and how impotent Israel is in the face of my attack. So he lets them do that. He lets them send out messengers. Obviously, Nahash is thinking Israel has no king. They have no leadership and is acting as such. It's not clear whether he would have known about the assembly. He may very well have known about the assembly. And he may have known that a king was selected by lots. But if he knew that, he also knew that there was dissent within Israel. And his thinking is that it won't make any difference. Messengers are sent out throughout Israel, And messengers are even sent to Gibeah. That's the city in which Saul lives. But it's interesting, messengers weren't sent to Saul. They aren't treating him as a king. So the messengers come to Gibeah, and they announce what's happening to the people of Gibeah in the square, probably, in the gates of the city, probably. And Saul just accidentally hears the outcry of the people and comes up and wants to know what's going on, what people are responding to. Now, there's some interesting background to this in Judges 19 through 21. I won't read that all. I'll just retell you the story. But it's interesting background that I think is helpful to keep in mind. At the end of the period of the Judges, there is an incident involving the concubine of a Levite priest. This Levite had this concubine, and she left him. He was from Ephraim, and she left him and went to her father's house in Judah. And this Levite priest wanted her back, so he decided he would go to his father's house and try to convince her father to let him take her back. So he goes down to, I think it's Bethlehem, where her father lived and where she was, and talks with her father for several days, and her father decides that it would be fine for her to go back with him. So this Levite priest and the concubine, they leave Bethlehem and start to make their way back to Ephraim. They get to Gibeah and decide that will need to spend the night there. Gibeah is in the territory of the Benjamites. And there is an Ephraimite that lives in Gibeah, and he tells this Levite priest, the Levite priest can't find any place to spend the night. And this man from Ephraim says, well, you can't spend it in the city square. Come and spend the night with me. So he does so. And in the evening, the men of Gibeah come to the house of this Ephraimite, and they demand that this Levite priest come out to them. I think it's explicit that they want to have sexual relations with him. The Ephraimite says, no, he's a guest in my house. I'll turn over my daughter and I'll turn over this concubine to you, but you can't have him. And the men of Gibeah are not happy with that. But the priest refuses to go out, and the concubine is sent out. And so the men of Gibeah take her away, and in the biblical account it says that the men ravished her all night. And in the morning, the Levite priest, when he comes out of the door of the house, there is his concubine's corpse lying on the doorstep, dead. So he takes the corpse back to Ephraim, to his home, cuts the body up into 12 pieces, and sends a piece to each tribe of Israel, and says, something needs to be done here. So the people of Israel gathered in an assembly and decided that they would require that every tribe provide some soldiers, and they would go to fight against the Benjaminites. And they did so. So there was a civil war then between the other tribes of Israel and the tribe of Benjamin, centered in Gibeah. And after a number of heavy losses on both sides, the 11 tribes defeat defeat the Benjamites. Then after they defeat the Benjamites, all of the tribes of Israel take an oath saying, we will not let any of our daughters marry a Benjamite. And the Benjamites complain that that is too harsh. That means that their tribe would not be able to continue to have offspring and to continue to survive. So the nations of Israel decide, well, there's one city that didn't send anybody to help fight against the Benjamites. We will go fight against them, and we will take all of the daughters there and give them over to the Benjamites as wives. And that city is Jabesh-Gilead. So it is daughters from Jabesh-Gilead that were given over to marriage to Benjamite men, and that's centered in Gibeah. So it makes sense now that when Jabesh-Gilead is besieged, that Gibeah would respond to that appeal first because there are family connections between the two cities. And that will also help explain why Saul does what he does in the next section. Verses 6 through 11. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. And he took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. Then the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man. And he numbered them in Bezek, and the sons of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. And they said to the messengers who had come, thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have deliverance. So the messengers went and told the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Then the men of Jabesh said, tomorrow we will come out to you, and you may do to us whatever seems good to you. And it happened the next morning that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp at the morning watch and struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it came about that those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. The Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily. I'm not sure exactly what that means. I suspect it means it inspired him. It gave him the confidence to take action and to call the people of Israel together for this effort. In order to make his appeal most strongly, he cuts into pieces a pair of oxen. So apparently, drawing upon the precedent of what the Levite had done with his concubine and the response that that got, he is using a similar strategy now to get a response from the people of Israel. So he cuts up two oxen and sends those pieces out to all of Israel. And he asked them all to come. If they don't come, then may the same happen to them. It's a veiled threat that accompanies each piece of ox. And notice that it is whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel. Saul doesn't feel like he has the authority to make this happen, so he signs Samuel's name onto his message as well. But the people do respond, and they respond in significant numbers. It records these as the numbers of people from Israel and the numbers of people from Judah. So it's in two categories, and that's interesting because later on we'll see that there is a significant divide between Judah and the rest of Israel. Now, this is going to be an ongoing problem. So here, they're already listed separately. The numbers, the 300,000, it's unlikely that there would have been an army of 300,000 from Israel. This could be all of the people from the rest of Israel that gathered together in order to take out of that the soldiers. In any case, we have a large representation from Israel and Judah that's coming to fight against the Ammonites. So Saul's confident of victory, and he sends a message to the people of Jabesh-Gilead. By the time the sun is hot, you will be delivered. So by noon, by early afternoon, you're going to be delivered. The people of Jabesh-Gilead are thrilled with the news, and so they tell Nahash, we'll come out afternoon. We'll turn ourselves over to you afternoon, and you can do with us whatever you want. Saul and his armies then attack early in the morning. Nahash probably thinks that things are quite secure, he and his soldiers. They have probably let down their guard a bit, and Saul takes advantage of that. They attack early in the morning. They disperse the Ammonite troops, and it says there that no two of them were left together. So they're just spread out all over the place in the face of this Israelite attack. Verses 12 through the end of the chapter. Then the people said to Samuel, "Who is he that said, 'Shall Saul reign over us?' Bring the men that we may put them to death." But Saul said, "Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel." Then Samuel said to the people, "Come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there." So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they also offered sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. So after this victory, Saul's a hero. And so people come to Samuel and they say, "Now tell us who the detractors of Saul were. Who were those worthless men that wouldn't follow Saul's lead? And we'll kill them." Saul at that point intervenes and he says, "Nobody's going to be killed." Saul's obviously wanting to be very conciliatory here. "Nobody's going to die because today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel." It would be inappropriate on the day that God has delivered Israel that we would put Israelites to death. So he keeps that from happening. Very conciliatory. So then Samuel kind of once again puts a stamp of approval on this kingdom. And now this is going to stick. Now it's going to be a kingdom because Saul has proven himself. He's done something notable that gives people assurance that he will be a good leader. So Samuel gathers them all at Gilgal. And it says, there they made Saul king before the Lord of Gilgal. So this is the first time that the people of Israel have made him king. They offer sacrifices to seal the deal, to commemorate this event. Okay, so now Saul is actually king in the eyes of the Israelites. It took a while, but now he is a king. And Samuel makes an address to all of Israel, kind of an address to commemorate, to mark this occasion when the kingdom is finally established as a reality. Verses 1 through 5. Then Samuel said to all Israel, "Behold, I have listened to your voice in all that you said to me, and I have appointed a king over you. And now here is the king walking before you. but I am old and gray. And behold, my sons are with you, and I have walked before you from my youth even to this day. Here I am. Bear witness against me before the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? I will restore it to you. And they said, you have not defrauded us or oppressed us or taken anything from any man's hand. And he said to them, the Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that you have found nothing in my hand. And they said, he is witness. This is the beginning of his speech. It's a strange way to start the speech, it seems to me. What he's asking is for the people to think back as to whether he has ever done anything wrong with respect to them. Has he ever stolen anything? Has he ever cheated anybody? Does anybody have any complaints? He points out that it has been since he was a youth that he has served in this capacity, that he has ruled over them. And throughout his lifetime, he has been without reproach. And the people agree. He has done nothing that was self-serving. He has been a good and faithful judge. I'm not sure why he starts out his account this way. It could be that in his old age, he just wants to make sure that all accounts are settled, but it seems like he says too much here for that to be the sole reason for why he's doing this. It could be that he wants to prove that he has not acted self-interestedly, and therefore his criticisms, his concerns with respect to the kingship are not self-interested, and his appointment of Saul is not out of self-interest. He's not just appointing someone who will be his flunky. But I suspect that the best explanation is that there was no justification for them to reject his leadership. If you will recall, they came to him and said, appoint a king over us. And Samuel first took that as a rejection of his leadership. God reassured him, no, it's not a rejection of your leadership, it's a rejection of my leadership. But I think Samuel continued to take it as a rejection of his leadership. And in fact, the Israelites, I think, were in a sense rejecting his leadership. And he is pointing out that he has acted in their interests throughout, and that their concerns were not justified. It is along those lines, it is curious that he mentions in verse 2, and behold, my sons are with you, that he would bring them up in this context is curious because, as you'll recall, when the Israelites came to him, one of their concerns was that his sons were not above reproach. They had been taking bribes and doing things that were unjust. Okay. So in any case, that's the way he begins. That's the preface for his remarks. He continues in verse 6. Then Samuel said to the people, it is the Lord who appointed Moses and Aaron and who brought your fathers up from the land of Egypt. So now take your stand, that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous acts of the Lord, which he did for you and your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt, and your fathers cried out to the Lord, then the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and settled them in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God. So he sold them into the hand of Sisera, captain of the army of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab. And they fought against them. And they cried out to the Lord, and said, we have sinned, because we have forsaken the Lord, and have served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. But now deliver us from the hands of our enemies, and we will serve thee. Then the Lord sent Jerubbaal and Bedan and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you from the hands of your enemies all around, so that you lived in security. Samuel is just recounting a bit of the history of Israel. He could have gone into much greater detail, but he's pointing out a pattern here. And the pattern is the people of Israel cry out because of their suffering, and it's suffering at the hands of some outside oppressor. And when they do that, God has responded and brought along someone to provide leadership. And that person provides leadership that is effective and frees them from their oppression. But after that happens, then the people of Israel forget their God. And they no longer accept the leadership that God has given to them, and they look elsewhere for help. And that's the pattern that's repeated here. That's the pattern that happened with Moses and Aaron in Egypt. That's the pattern that happened causes God to send Jerubbaal and Bedan and Jephthah and Samuel, all of those in rising up against oppressors in Israel. Just as a comment, Bedan is not mentioned elsewhere in the Bible, and it's thought that that must be another name for Barak, who would have been that's the name that would have been appropriate in that spot in Judges. Okay, so that's the pattern that's been observed. He continues. When you saw that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came against you, you said to me, "No, but a king shall reign over us," although the Lord your God was your king. Now, therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen, whom you have asked for. And behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and listen to his voice and not rebel against the command of the Lord, then both you and also the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God. And if you will not listen to the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers. Even now, take your stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call to the Lord, that he may send thunder and rain. Then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord by asking for yourselves a king. So Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. So having given that pattern, he points out that the thing that gave rise to the appointment of a king was that they were afraid of Nahash and the Ammonites, and they wanted a king to rule over them in order to provide them the kind of leadership that they could feel confident in, leadership that has continuity and leadership that is responsive to the cries of the people of Israel. In response to that, God gave them a king. Saul is that man. It's interesting. He says, here is the king whom you have chosen. Well, they didn't choose Saul. They chose to have a king. And apparently Samuel is saying, and this is the man that has been selected to answer your request for to have a king, your choice to have a king. Then he says, basically, if you will serve God faithfully, then the king that you have will follow God and you as a people will follow God. If you don't, then your king won't, and you won't, and you will suffer as a result of that. Then he offers a sign to show that God looks upon their request for a king unfavorably, that it was a sinful thing that they did to ask for a king. He says, is it not the wheat harvest today? So what he's saying is this not August? Is this not at the end of the summer? And in Israel, as I understand it, at that time of year, rain virtually never happens. So what he's saying is this not the time of year when rain doesn't happen? Okay, well, rain is going to happen today. There's going to be thunder and rain on this day. Not only does rain not happen, but if this is wheat harvest, then rain is a bad thing. Rain is going to do damage to the harvest, to the crop. So this is going to be a sign that is not only wondrous, but it's painful. They're going to suffer as a result of this. And why? What is this a sign of? It says, then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord by asking for yourselves a king. That's what this sign attests to. And it happened, and in response it says, all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. So people respond to that in fear, because this is a painful sign. Next section. Then all the people said to Samuel, pray for your servants to the Lord your God, so that we may not die. For we have added to all our sins this evil by asking for ourselves a king. And Samuel said to the people, do not fear. You have committed all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And you must not turn aside, for then you would go after futile things which cannot profit or deliver, because they are futile. For the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you. But I will instruct you in the good and right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king shall be swept away. It's interesting, their response is a recognition that what they did was wrong, and now they would like to erase that as if it had never happened. And Samuel's response is, no, there's no putting the genie back in the box. Not once a deed is done, a deed has been done. You can't undo that. Things have already been put in motion. Your request for a king has been granted. A king has been established. You now have a king. It is your obligation to serve that king. None of that is going to be undone. It can't be undone. But that doesn't mean that all is hopeless. Far from it. That now your responsibility is to pick up from here and continue on, but continue on in faith. Continue on serving your God. Continue on in obedience. And there's reassurance. It says, for the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name. God has made a commitment. God has attached his name to that commitment, and he won't retract that commitment. He's committed to this people that he brought into being, and he will not retract that. They can count on that. And he assures them that he will continue to pray for them. It would be wrong for him to not do so. And he will instruct them in the good and the right way. So he'll pray for them, and he will help them to understand better what it would mean to be for them to be obedient to God. Last two verses are very, very to the point. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart. For consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king shall be swept away. So that's the speech that he delivered to the Israelites at this occasion of the kingdom actually coming into real existence, one that's recognized by the people of Israel. Now, there are three comments I'd like to make with respect to this passage. The first is that it is interesting to me that Saul was selected as king, but was not recognized as king by the people of Israel until he produced results. It was not enough that Saul was anointed. That happened privately. It was not enough that he was selected by a lottery in front of all of the people of Israel. That was a very public event. That they weren't, obviously they're thinking, it's not enough for those things to happen. And by saying it's not enough for those things to happen, they're saying it's not enough for God to pick someone out. We want someone who will produce results. And until it's someone who will produce results, we aren't behind him. We won't follow him. He has to be the kind of leader that we want. Practically speaking, what the Israelites were looking for is someone who could lead them successfully against their oppressors. And until they were confident that Saul could do that, they aren't interested in giving him their allegiance. That's the same pattern that they showed with respect to Moses, as you'll recall in the wilderness. Whenever Moses didn't provide the kinds of results that they wanted, they called his leadership into question. They rejected him as leader. They're looking for very specific and concrete results all along the way. And if their leader can't provide that, then he's not a good leader. I think that this is, I find this very interesting. And as I was thinking about this, I generated quite a tirade about this that I could spin off into, but I will not. But with respect to some of the things that are required at Gutenberg in order to meet to satisfy the accrediting association, there's great emphasis placed on measurable outcomes, that they would like us to establish these measurable outcomes and measure those outcomes and make sure that we're a good institution, because we can show them that we have these numbers that demonstrate that we met these measurable outcomes. And all of this is being pushed by what's happened in the business world. And the model in the business world is being copied in other parts of our society, and they want to apply that to education now. But short of a tirade, I just think it is worthy of note that none of those things which are most important in the world are measurable outcomes. Anything that's important is immeasurable. The only trivial things are measurable. So if an organization is going to chase measurable outcomes, it's going to be chasing things that are trivial. And with respect to organizations in general and mission statements, and there's a lot of emphasis on that when we talk to the Accrediting Association, I'm convinced that there is no organizational mission that trumps everybody's individual mission that's given to us by God, and that is to love one another. Organizations are just an excuse to bring us together in such a way that we have to love one another. If it never meets its mission statement, I would say that doesn't mean it's a bad organization. It may be a very good organization because it's meeting that higher goal of bringing us together in a way that we have to work with one another and deal with one another in a way that's edifying and loving. Okay, that's short of a tirade. The next thing that I think is interesting in this passage is the connection between the people and the king. Essentially, what Samuel is saying is, if you are a good people, you will have a good king. And if you are a bad people, you will have a bad king. And the question is there a natural connection between those two? Or is this a supernatural thing that God is saying? He's saying, if you are good, I will intervene in such a way that your leader will be good, in a supernatural way, such that your leader will be good. And that is only true of you, Israel. Or is that true more broadly? Is that true in other countries, that people get the leadership that they deserve? Or is there no such connection? I know that before I started my graduate work in history, I would have been inclined to say that there is no natural connection. But as a result of my studies, I am more inclined to think that there is a natural connection. That for two reasons. One is that there are limits on what a leader can do. There are huge limits on what a leader can do. That what a leader can do is largely dependent on what the led allow to be done. So it doesn't matter what leader you have in position. To a large extent, what happens is going to happen as a result of who the people are. And we ought not underestimate that. We are social beings. We all have an impact on one another. And it doesn't matter if you have someone who is a leader who is of the class of a noble family, someone who's born into that position. And so there's a big class difference between him and the commoner. Nevertheless, there is going to be an impact of society on that leader and what he can do and what he can't do. And furthermore, I have come to believe that leaders are largely shaped by the led. I don't know if I've mentioned this in this context, but it was interesting when my children were involved in soccer that there were times when the coach would designate someone as the team captain. And if that team captain was treated by the coach as a team captain, that it didn't matter who that player was, that person would start to act like a leader and act like a team captain and start to act out that role. And I think that that's a phenomenon that we underestimate, that leaders are made to a large extent. And they're made by the way that people interact with them. And the people that are led help to shape the leader, and vice versa. So I think that there, to a large extent, this is a general principle. To a large extent, people do get the leadership that they deserve for a variety of reasons. Okay, the third thing that I'd like to talk about is this issue that is one that I think about a lot, actually. Samuel's comments as to how to remain faithful. What are the people of Israel supposed to do so that they do remain faithful? This last verse, second to last verse, only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. Part of being faithful is remembering and keeping things into perspective. And God has done a lot of things that are of significance for the people of Israel. And one of the themes that keeps coming up in the Old Testament is that the people of Israel are supposed to remember the Exodus. That was a huge event in Israel's history in which God acted overtly in history on their behalf, and they're to remember that. And there were other things that God had done along the way that were very significant, and they're encouraged to remember those, keep those in mind. But I don't think remembering those great events is adequate. I was reading this week about the conflict between the Greeks and the Persians in what, 4th and 5th century BC? And the Persians had a grievance against the Greeks, and so they attacked the Greeks on two different occasions, separated by 10 years. And on the second of those occasions, they thought they had defeated the Greeks, and so they desecrated one of the temples in Athens as proof of their superiority. But then the Persians were defeated. Just a few days later, the Persians were defeated, and they had to retreat. The Greeks then, they remembered that desecration of the temple and were going to get revenge on the Persians. So later, they desecrated a temple in Asia Minor of the Persians. So now we've got both sides with grievances, and both sides have victories that are rather remarkable victories that they attribute to their God being more powerful than the other one's God. So then we have Alexander the Great coming along. He goes over and defeats the Persians in rather remarkable circumstances and attributes that to the Greek gods. So both sides are able to look at events that are rather remarkable and say, that shows that my God is dominant. They both have defeats that they can point, that they need look back to, and they say, well, that was punishment for one thing or another, but that's not the last word. And the problem is, if you look at the history of Israel, there are lots of horrendous things that have happened to them since the Exodus. And most recently, there was a destruction, there was a destruction of the temple in 70 AD, which was a horrible thing to happen recently. And there was the diaspora in which they were sent out into all the rest of the world, essentially. There was the Holocaust. I mean, there are a number of huge, horrible things that have happened to the nation of Israel. Those things that God has done in the history of Israel on their behalf, like the Exodus, Those are very significant. But I don't think when Samuel is saying that you are to consider what great things he has done for you, I don't think he's talking about just a list of those big events. I think there are other great things that he has accomplished, that there's a sense in which they're more important. And those great things are revealing to the people of Israel what is good and what is evil, and helping them to come along to understand what those things are and to respond to those and embrace those things and to live them out to the extent that they have done that from time to time. That as I think about my relationship with God and how he has worked with me, there are some significant things that he has done in my life. There are isolated events which I can look back at and say, that was remarkable. And I think it is important to remember those. But more significantly, he's transformed my thinking about what's important in the world. And he's brought me along to see that which is good is truly good and is extremely valuable. It's more valuable than anything else. That's an amazing transformation. And furthermore, it's self-authenticating, because there's something so right, there's something so true about that which is good and proper, that it's just a fit to come for God to develop in one a taste for that which is right, and to look at the world and see how well that which is right fits in with reality and answers what life is all about. That, I think, is in a sense a greater thing, and is the kind of thing that also needs to be a part of what we keep in mind when we reflect on what God has done. It's not as showy, but in the long run, it's more substantial, more significant. And I think that Samuel is calling them to look at the bigger picture and to reflect on what God has done in the history of Israel with respect to establishing what is good and proper and true in life. And that's really significant. Okay. A little time for questions and comments.
I just want to make sure it's on. I was thinking about what you were saying about Israel's relationship and so on, and about your experience with the university, and it became clear to me that's basically how a lot of people deal with each other. Instead of looking for those things that have deeper meaning, such as, well, I may be picking, but I don't get called enough, don't get enough letters, don't get enough presents, you know, so on and so on. And I think it's coming out of more of this materialistic type of thinking that I really don't even think it's just today. I think it's kind of cycles. And I think that has affected the business world and has crept into the education world too.
The difficulty of coming to value that which is valuable is huge. And it's not the kind of thing that you solve and then it's solved for your lifetime. It's the kind of thing that you have to keep coming back to and struggling with. And in the face of cultural voices that keep telling us that there are other things that are more important. So it's a huge struggle that we'll face all of our lives.
That confliction, David, for the people of Israel then, as they wanted a king, and at the same time God wanted their faithfulness, is not different from yours and my confliction right now. And similar to this question, we are in a complex, flat world, democratized society, and rules are necessary. The rules for Gutenberg and the rules for international peacefulness. But I respect and appreciate your impression of the real things that we need to learn are the things you've talked about today. How indeed can you participate with the rules, in that words, Samuel got the king, and at the same time respect the request of God, look for faithfulness and truthfulness? And I would ask you in that answer to emphasize the latter as opposed to the former. Emphasize the ways that you can cooperate. You can teach at Gutenberg those things that you find very important at the same time as cooperating with the rules and regulations, because in order to keep it open, it's you're going to have to. But just a little bit further on, how does it look to seek truthfulness, righteousness, in the face of this complex, flat world, which requires, you know, democratization and getting along and cooperation, and it just doesn't happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a huge question. I mean, it's a question of how do we come to value that which is valuable, and that's something that is an education process that God takes us through all life long. And it's a combination of reflecting on our own experience and learning more from God's word. I mean, getting input from experience as well as from God's objective special revelation, and just taking seriously that project of trying to sort that out and understand it. Because every situation's unique. And so every situation presents its own unique challenge as to how do I keep my priorities straight in the face of this particular situation? And what would those values dictate that I do? And we have those assignments many times daily where we have to work that out. But we work that out at the same time that God is instructing us. So we aren't alone in doing that. It's a daunting project, but we aren't alone in doing that. As we are working at it, God is working to teach us as well.
Thanks. A quick historical question. Did the peoples of Israel and the peoples of Judah eventually separate in their loyalty to God? And do you mind answering at a little bit at this point about what's going to happen to these people who are located in Israel in this setting, the near future? Will the people of Judah be the loyal ones, and what will happen to the people of Israel?
After Saul, David becomes king, and David is from the tribe of Judah. So even at that point in time, there's a sense in which Judah is more loyal to the king than is the rest of Israel. Then after David dies, Solomon becomes king. He is recognized as king by all of Israel, Judah and the rest of Israel, but he's from the tribe of Judah. But when Solomon dies, at that point, there will be a split, and Judah will recognize one king, and the rest of Israel will recognize another king. And that's when you have the divide between Israel and Judah. And then the tribe of Israel, the nation of Israel, it is going to be the first to turn against God and to be conquered by the Assyrians, and many of them taken into exile. Judah will follow later. I'm going to need to quit so we can save the childcare workers.